This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, civil rights groups want to sue the FBI for watching them and white flight from South Africa. From NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Joining us from Maryland, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. And joining me here in our New York bureau, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy. All right, folks, let's get right into this question of the FBI, quote, spying once again. No surprise there to most, but here's what might be found interesting. The FBI has thousands of pages of records in its files relating to monitoring civil rights and environmental and similar advocacy groups. The Justice Department has acknowledged that. But groups like the ACLU and Greenpeace are suggesting that the material will show that they have been subjected to scrutiny by the FBI based on the fact that these groups, the FBI's groups, have been set up for counterterrorism, to combat terrorism. When you hear this, Mary Frances Berry, clearly some of the concern of the extensions of the Patriot Act come to bear.
Absolutely. And this, like everything else, has a history. COINTELPRO, the 1960s, 1970s, the surveillance. I, in fact, was under surveillance by the FBI during the anti-war movement when I was a student at Michigan. And lots of people were. We all found out we had files later, primarily just because we were against the war. So we've been through this. The church hearings and the Senate brought all that out. There are volumes of information about how you can abuse the FBI's responsibility. I think since 9/11, we have a tendency here and with the opposition to the war against Iraq to sort of identify people and to see if anything can be found about them and to define expressing one's First Amendment freedoms as terrorism. It's the counterterrorism, the definition of terrorism. For the ACLU, my goodness, they wouldn't know how to engage in a terrorist act if, you know, if one ran up against them or something. I mean, they wouldn't know what that is. I mean, they're against terrorism. So it's threatening. It might have a chilling effect. Some people may be identified and have bad things happen to them just because of their First Amendment activities. It's just bad news all around.
John?
Well, it's a difficult issue. I certainly am not in favor of excessive surveillance of people for petty reasons, such as we're all familiar with, for example, Dr. King. But when it comes to this one, it seems to me that it's almost a surprise that some new Terry McVeigh hasn't done some terrible thing because he's angry at Bush and Cheney. And as we learned in London last week, terrorism can sometimes come from within. And I'm not sure that I have the expertise to say that I know just where the line should be drawn in terms of investigating people, as long as it doesn't go into abuse. I do believe that we do have to sacrifice a bit of privacy in times like these. But certainly we don't want to go back to the sorts of things that were considered normal before. Sometimes I hope that history progresses. It's not always clear that it does.
ACLU is not Terry McVeigh. It's nowhere near that. I mean, the Terry McVeigh, the people who are in that category, who are well known to the FBI, groups and individuals like that, of course they should keep them under surveillance. But the ACLU, come on.
No, it's not. It's the thing
I think
is,
what we're talking about.
Sure,
hold on, let me get in on this. Hold on a second, John. Let me get in on this. Look, we're talking about people in the free expression of the First Amendment rights. That's what we're talking about. And basically, we do have a long history of abuse of this. I mean, David Garrow wrote a whole book on the FBI and Dr. King where they sent him tapes urging him to commit suicide and basically monitoring the lawful expression of First Amendment rights. And that's the concern, and that's what something we can't ignore.
Well, Mary raises an interesting point, and I'm wondering, Mary, where the line is drawn when you talk about a Timothy McVeigh. That's an individual. When we talk about groups, one will make an argument and probably align themselves with you as relates to the ACLU, but others might argue that groups like Greenpeace and the like will walk that fine line where historically there might have been some things in the past of this group that would quantify the idea of looking into them as a quote-unquote through a terrorist subgroup.
What Ed said.
And there isn't even anything about Greenpeace, which, of course, has engaged in some environmental actions which go over the line, in my view, from time to time. There's nothing about them that makes it appear that they would engage in the kind of massive counterterrorism against the United States
Not
and the United
directly.
States government and attack the president and attack all
Not
kinds
them.
Of people. I mean, that's just going a little far.
But it's a matter of connections, people operating on the fringes, hints that you might get from roles and things like that.
And
terrorism
George,
isn't going to come from expected places.
George, isn't that the catch-22 here where the line is drawn?
It's not a catch-22. I mean, you know, this is the same kind of innuendo that was used during the Civil Rights Movement. Well, this person may be a member of the Communist Party. If you're talking about terrorism, they need to be monitoring the groups that Terry McVeigh's come from. There are known clear-cut groups that make this express purpose. This is what they plan to do. These groups are not among those groups.
Timothy
shouldn't
McVeigh.
Be applied to them.
Timothy McVeigh. Okay.
Yes.
So before we move on, Mary, let me take the question of the line to you. Who
okay.
draws the line? Who says this group is appropriate to look into, this group is not? And what kind of oversee can you have with this?
All right. Well, the government probably would say it wants to err on the side of violating privacy and monitoring everybody if it could, just so if anything happens, no one can be blamed and no one will be harmed. That's one approach. The other is to look at the history of groups and what they've done and who's involved in them, and to identify what they've been doing, and that's why I'm set at the ACLU, and to figure out how likely is it that the people who are in this organization are the ones that we ought to spend the limited resources. We keep talking about how we don't have resources. We don't even have money to pay for protecting mass transit in cities, for example. Mm-hmm. Should we be spending our money on collecting files on the ACLU? So the line drawing has to have civil liberties and civil rights concerns, but also resource concerns, the history of organizations, their propensity for violence, what it is they've done in the past, and what do we expect them to do.
All right. Take a look at another issue that is interesting because it mirrors to a great degree what we saw happen in the late 1960s and early 1970s in this country. And there is a fear by some of white flight in South Africa. There is surging violence in some areas, and we are finding that many whites are suggesting, based on the aggressive affirmative action programs that are now in place, that they feel left out, if you will. And many say that this is no longer a place for them. Yet, with the wealth that many of these families still hold, own, and control, one must take a look at if they leave en masse the problems that this country will be besieged with, George Curry.
Left out. I mean, gee, they aren't the people who've been left out over the years. Basically, what you have is an aggressive affirmative action program, and you can argue about the extent that it goes. I mean, you know, that's fair game. But the fact is, in order to share into the wealth of this country and opportunities, they're creating a strong affirmative action program. This is not unique to South Africa. India has one even stronger than this. So, of course, as usual, there's always going to be an uproar over it. But, I mean, you know, get over it.
John? Affirmative action is very important in a country like South Africa right now, just as I think it was in the United States starting in the late 60s. The only issue is whether you put a time limit on it and when. And as you see in countries around the world, including India and Sri Lanka, when you don't put a time limit on it, then terrible things can happen. Ultimately, I think you have to teach a man to fish rather than giving him one. But at first, to reverse, you know, the ills of history, certainly you need to crack some eggs. And so there needs to be affirmative action. And the number of whites who are actually going to leave South Africa is probably about the number of people who are actually going to move to Canada because we've got a second Bush administration. A lot of that is just talk. I think they need to just sit tight and deal with a very awkward stage in the country's history.
Ed, as somebody who was along with Randall Robinson, Sylvia Hill, Roger Wilkins, and others, the leader of a Free South Africa movement in this country, and having been to South Africa on several occasions, I find this whole discussion of white flight heartbreaking. The affirmative action is just the tip of the iceberg. Of course, they now need affirmative action to make up for the past. But there are millions of poor people in South Africa who are as poverty-stricken as they were during the period of apartheid. Some of them are still living in the same camps, or their children mm-hmm. are, that they lived in, Crossroads and other places and shanty towns that they lived in during that period. Mbeki and the ANC have a tough problem, a tightrope to walk. If they do too much to try to improve things, they may destroy the economy, whites will leave, and there'll be a Zimbabwe basket case, as we call it, because the world won't help them. If they don't do something, then the poor will rise up, and you can have real chaos in South Africa. So as they sort of walk this tightrope, I would hope that the whites who were there and who were complicit, some of them, in apartheid would be more understanding and not be so concerned about their own personal, what's happening to me personally, and as some of them who were quoted in the story are concerned about the country, and go along and let the government find its way democratically and not fall into the Zimbabwe trap on the one hand, and on the other hand, not try to make steps to improve things for the masses of the poor there.
We'll turn our attention to a longstanding trademark fight, and it's interesting because it's a debate that's been going on in the world of sports for some time. A U.S. Court of Appeals said that this case deserves another look because one of the plaintiffs involved might not have had a fair right in its pursuit, and it is a group of Native Americans who have suggested that trademarking and covering the names and logos of, in particular, the Washington Redskins, but you can think to the Cleveland Indians and some of the other football teams, particularly in college, that utilize as a logo an Indian, a Native American, and the idea that many Native Americans find this degrading and disparaging to their people. George Curry, A, what's your thought on the idea of teams utilizing a person's ethnicity as a logo?
I don't think that Native Americans object to just using that if it's used in a respectful way. I mean, you look at the Redskins, look at Cleveland Indians. That's the worst example for me. You look at that Indian that they use for baseball, and it's absolutely obnoxious. So I think that they're more worried about the exploitation, the misuse of it, the stereotypes and these kinds of things, the use of it itself. Now, in this case, you're talking about a trademark issue, and the question here really is whether they waited too long to file a trademark challenge.
I'd like to take a page from actually a white woman who was discussing this issue a couple of years ago at the University of Virginia. And she said, having a team today called the Redskins is like having a team called the Niggers. And the campus was in an uproar against this white woman uttering that word, and Julian Bond slapped her hand. Well, I think, as we all know, she was absolutely right. And I think that the name Redskins sounds innocent to us because Native Americans are rather far from the experience of most of us. And I actually hope that it can be fixed on a technicality. And if not, I think it would be a moral good for the team to just change it themselves. That's a slur, as familiar as it is to us.
And I agree with all of that. And when I was chair of the commission, we passed a resolution encouraging the disuse of mascots. And there's a Say No to Mascots movement among the American Indians, Native Americans, of which this whole Redskin thing is a part. But the other point I wanted to make that I found interesting about this story is that the judge ruled that the reason why they hadn't slept on their rights, the Native Americans hadn't, is because there was one plaintiff who was only 1 year old in 1967 and couldn't have slept on their rights because they were too young to sue. And that reminded me that when African Americans sued to try to get reparations in the period after the Civil War, and I hate to say this, but I got another book, Ed, about that too, coming out in September, they were told that they had slept on their rights, even though one of the plaintiffs, too, was somebody who was a child at the time and at the end of slavery and couldn't have sued because, and so I'm interested in seeing how this whole thing turns out. But I agree that teams ought to review this and see if they can find some other names.
We'll look forward to that book, Mary, and of course be talking to you in September when it comes out. But that being said, George Curry, it does seem to me that John brings up an interesting point. It is because of the lack of political muscle, quite frankly, that Native Americans have in this country that we don't see the same kind of uproar and pressure put on particularly professional teams and big college teams that make a whole lot of money and, quite frankly, would take this to the Supreme Court if they had to. They are not going to, no matter how much yelling and protesting that they find initially, are going to change what they have had for years as the Mighty Teams logo.
You're right that the political muscle isn't there, but there are a lot of college teams that have changed on their own, I'm glad to say. I mean, they have actually changed. And so it's not that they can't.
But none of the major colleges, and that's why I made the distinction, none of the major colleges have changed their mascot.
Yeah, University of Illinois, for example, practically ran the chancellor out of town, a wonderful woman who's now president up at Syracuse, and because she was trying to support the people who wanted to get rid of their chief mascot. I've forgotten what the name of the Illinois team is. They're Big Ten, I guess, team, or Big 12. So you're right. None of the biggies have gotten rid of them. And I doubt seriously, even though they ought to do it, that the Redskins will do it. It's sort of arrogance. Unless somebody orders, there's an order somewhere to make this happen, I doubt that it's going to happen.
And I mentioned the Indians. You know, you have other teams like the Braves, too. You know, Chief Nakahoma.
Oh, yeah.
In Atlanta.
Well, we're told by one of our producers, thank you, Tashima, that it's Chief, what is it?
In Atlanta?
Illini.
Oh, Illinois.
Well,
your producer knows the name of the Chief.
Yes, indeed. We're quick here. Let me ask you this real quick, though. When you know for certain that some of these actions, John, offend a group of people. I can remember some years ago when the Braves were on national television playing in the World Series, and the focus was much on the tomahawk chop. This was when Ted Turner and Jane Fonda were being focused on, and she even came under some criticism for utilizing it. When you know it is offensive, when you know there's not a question to X number of people, should not more pressure be put on these groups by those of us who've faced this kind of degradation and problem throughout history?
I would say without a doubt, because it makes for a consistency and a moral consistency so that there is perhaps a lesser number of people who say, when we as African Americans have some kind of complaint or a grievance to air, that we're just indulging in some sort of sport or being self-centered. These are general principles, and so I think we should all think about that.
All right. Mary Frances Berry, who has a book coming out in September, and we'll have her here to talk about it. John McWhorter and George Curry, who saved us at the last minute, who wasn't scheduled to join us today, but in fact came through for us. George, thank you very much. Greatly appreciate
quite
it.
Quite welcome. Enjoy
good
it.
Good to talk to you too, George.
All right. I'll talk to you in September, Mary.